start to learn then one of us as Christians, at least I hope, one of the verses that we realize, Hebrews 9:22, where it says, but not because of, or as one could almost say, without blood, there is no forgiveness of sin. And we know that, and ultimately because of what Jesus did on the cross for us. Let's get going. Our author has shared much about the legitimacy of Christ's priesthood, which was carefully explained as being after the order of Melchizedek. He spent a lot of time in that in several different chapters on the order of Melchizedek. Because this kind of priest cannot serve under the old covenant, Christ has also mediated a new covenant suitable to his work. We needed an Aaronic priest to mediate under the law of Moses. Under the new covenant, we needed a whole different priest. That is one according to the order of Melchizedek. That is Christ. Chapter 9 contrasts the sanctuaries and the rituals of the two covenants, and then, by a play on words, demonstrates another blessing Christ's death gives his people. 9:1. The purpose of this writing is to convince those tempted to leave Christianity and go back under the law that the law was faulty. So when I wrote that, or when I saw that, it probably in the Edward Fudge book that we're using, we have a difficult time understanding why anyone would want to go back to the law, the sacrifices, the constant bloodshed of animals that one had to share in to make that happen. Can't remember reading, I believe it was in one of Josephus' texts, that when he talked about on the Day of Atonement, how many thousands upon thousands of animals were sacrificed, and how literally the different gates that they had there around the city of Jerusalem, the gates, passageways that they would have, that would flow of basically canals full of blood that would run out the city, one particularly run out towards Gehenna and other places as well. But I guess what I'm saying is, why we just, at least in my mind, I have a hard time understanding why. I mean, we had our fair share of dad always getting deer, taking, you know, gutting, field dressing deer. Rick's job, those other guys that are hunters that do the same thing. Rick's job as a butcher gets that and understands that from a very intimate position. You know, we butchered chickens, different kinds of things growing up, and it's just, I'll just say it didn't excite me to be involved in any of those things, you know. And then to look at it from a spiritual aspect, I think, and especially where we're at in the time frame of Christianity, it's not like this was yesterday that Jesus was on the cross. We're talking several years down the road where this is happening, and the people are thinking, well, let's go back to the way it used to be. Aren't we thankful that we are not like that today? And I mean that with all sincerity. Because there's not a one of us that'll sit, even a 16-year-old or an 18-year-old that you'll sit down and have a conversation with, that it won't be too long that you'll be talking about something, and they may not in these words refer to it. But remember the good old days? The 16-year-old or the 18-year-old might say, remember when we used to do this instead of this? I like that so much better. That's exactly what the Hebrews, the Jews, were doing with Christianity. The Lord's Supper. I liked it so much better when we had to drag a goat down to the priest. Did you really? We say things that we really don't mean. We say things that if we stop and think about it, that's just ludicrous. It makes no sense. But yet, we'll say it, and there are those that'll sometimes ultimately play it out. Because for some whatever reason in their mind, that makes more sense. Or, you know, it was good enough for grandpa and grandma, so it's got to be good enough for me. Things change. Things change. I'm sure most of us, our great-great-grandparents traveled around in a horse and wagon. That doesn't mean I want to go out in the morning and hook up the horse to the buckboard and ride that to school. There's a time where we have to move on and take what is given there for the better. But these Jews were saying, let's go back. But so what the writer is doing, what Paul is trying to do, is show them that if we go back under the law, the things that were wrong with the law. Remember what Paul says about if you've sinned and you're guilty of one point of the law, you are guilty of what? All the law. Now, I try not to pick on Andrew, but sometimes his line of work just helps us out, right? So how would this be, Andrew, if and you've probably had people say this, well, I suppose you're going to throw the book at me, right? And so somebody is jaywalking here in Harlan, okay? So they're down here at Roberts and 37, and instead of going from Roberts, on this side of Roberts, across to Roberts, and then over to the house on the corner, they just run straight across. Lights go on, Andrew zips out, pulls in, tires squealing, jumps out, pulls his gun out, and it says, freeze! I was going to say, freeze, sucker, but I don't want to say that. Anyway, he says, freeze, right? And the guy's like, okay. And Andrew's like, all right, you broke one point of the law? You're going to the electric chair. You're guilty of all the law. Now, does that sound cool? But that's what these Hebrews are wanting to do. And that's why Paul is trying to point out to them the faultiness of the law. That if we get hung up on that and we see that we do we really want the law? If we're guilty of one point of the law, we're guilty of the entire law. Now I know right away, at least I think some of it would be like, well, that's not fair. Right, but that's what you're wanting. That's what you're wanting to go back to, because that's what Paul said. There's a slight debate in this verse, this very first verse, where some versions read covenant and others will read tabernacle. Now, in the study for this, I know George uses like 256 different versions. I usually have like eight or so on my thing. Only one of them came up with the point of using the word tabernacle instead of covenant here. And that was Young's literal translation that came up with all the other ones that I have, Bible in Basic English, the Easy to Read, the English Standard, the New American Standard, King James, New King James, and the, I got one other one, but I can't think of what it is. But anyway, they all read Covenant. So it's not like this is a popular thing, but it is a translation problem that some have. One can notice the word covenant or tabernacle may be in italics, which means that it was not there in the original text. There is no Greek word in the original following the word first, so we must insert it in there to understand what is being shared. The context implies it is speaking of the distinction between the two covenants. The regulations for the worship under the old covenant did not originate with man, but was instituted by God. And so our thought could be, well, let's just go back to the way that God originally planned it, right? Because some people have the idea, well, things didn't go the way God wanted it to, so he had to come up with a second plan or a second covenant. No, it went exactly the way, because what he wants for us to understand is how much better we do have it with Jesus Christ versus this old covenant. But as we said, sometimes we as humans are slow, are less than smart when it comes to things, and we want to revert back to something that may be harder just because it's something we're used to. Hebrews 9:1. Now, even the first covenant had regulations of divine worship and the earthly sanctuary. The first covenant involved ordinances and arrangements for divine service. But the sanctuary in which these were carried out was worldly. It was, as verse 9 will show, a figure of something more substantial in the eternal order. That means this was here for us to kind of get an idea, to grasp a hold of what this reason was, but it's going to explain to us why this was so much better than what they had. But take notice to what is said. Had regulations, as in the past tense. It is in the past tense since the new covenant has been inaugurated. This is referring to the rules of worship and priestly work. The leaving of those regulations of divine worship was something designed by God, not by man. God instituted the construction of the tabernacle of the earthly sanctuary, which was to be contrast between the heavenly sanctuary. It is called earthly in contrast to the heavenly. I remember through the years, two guys that would spend much time and had great messages on this very topic that I still I wish I remembered more to this day, but I still remember. One would be Rick Breitenball, and the second, Kevin Yeager. And they always had good things on the comparisons of the types of those things for us. And they always referred to those of the earthly tabernacle and the heavenlies, the things that were in heaven. And as we look at that, it was a reminder to us that the earthly is that which was on earth. It is earthly in that it was focused on the fleshly stuff. The earthly one was made by human hands, still designed by God, but made by earthly hands. The verse is speaking of the entire tabernacle structure. Outside stood two pieces of furniture, the altar of sacrifice and the laver. Once again, I hope you remember, and we'll obviously as we go through this, but so we come to the tabernacle. And it would have had the pillars and the curtains that were all around the main courtyard, which was called the courtyard of was the courtyard of women, or the basically the area in which anyone could go. And as we look at that, that is the world. That's the type that we see. Those are the ones that we are in contact with. They may just walk in there and walk around and see what's going on. They've got the courtyard of the world. And then there were two items that would be seen as you were walking around there. And we know those, as we said, was the altar of sacrifice, the brazen altar. To us, that would be our Calvary, where Jesus died, where the sacrifice was made. Once again, I don't know if it's just the denominational world trying to take some of their instruments that they use for their worship, but it's almost as if they try to downplay the size of these things. This altar was huge, was big. As a matter of fact, we even see from some of that when the priest was working, right? I use this a lot, the work of the priest, as Peter does in discussion of in 1 Peter 2, when he talks about that we are a royal priesthood, that we are a holy people, a holy nation. And he looks at the work that they do as just makes a comparison for the priest to that of a Christian. One of the things I always like to point out, if at all possible, and we'll do some other things here, was the priest on duty carrying out the task was not allowed to touch alcohol. So we as Christians in that typology, when are we on duty? Can you ever take off as being a Christian, punch the time clock, and be out? No. And so I use that as that representative. I say that to say this then. So there were also how the priest should dress. And it talks about them going there, and it'll talk about their linen breeches. Because for the most part, what this was a big platform that they would go up on, and they would sacrifice these bulls and these goats and all these different things. And with all the people standing underneath of them, looking up, oh my goodness, right? So the Lord had made provision for that. They had their linen breeches, is what some of the translations say, that would come down to at least their knees. Again, I think maybe that's just a, and I know I'll hear it, but it's just a, and they'll say, well, that's Old Testament. I know, again, these are types. Understand that. But why was that necessary? Because if someone would expose their thighs in public, it was exposing their nakedness to everyone else. And so as they would be lifted up there doing their job, working for the Lord, they'd say, well, they need to be careful with that. There was provisions made for that. And again, so maybe that's a little indication to us. Once again, we as Christians, maybe our thoughts are using this type of not exposing our nakedness to the world. That's what they were thinking. And there's, we can go on of illustration after illustration after illustration. But I just want for us to understand that this is that first point. The first point that we come to, the brazen altar, the place of sacrifice, that these were things, the work that was being done by the priest. It's not just about the material objects that are here. It's about the holy service that we as Christians are to be involved in as well. And so as we look at that and we share those things, I think there's places that we can learn. There's places that we can grow our spirituality. If we would do these things, remember we had talked a few weeks ago about those that would do things in the public areas, in the tabernacle, and not care what other people thought. Remember Gabby, Cosby, and Zimri, right? She was the one that came up to me. I couldn't think of their names during the service, but she came up to me and pointed out, and they got a spear run through them because they didn't care what other people thought. Well, guess what? God cares. So when we say, it doesn't matter what I wear, God cares. When we say, it doesn't matter what I drink in the privacy of my own home, God cares. And so as we look at these things, they're just typology things for us to say. This is what the Lord had in mind and his intentions were in the Old Testament. Let's look at that and just see some of the things that we could reflect on for the New Testament in our spiritual service towards him. Now, I know some of you will be saying, well, I thought the whole point of this message was that we're saying how much better the new is. Right, but that doesn't mean those principles still aren't there. What it's telling us is there's the earthly side of things, and so as we are on the spiritual side of things, shouldn't we be more spiritual-minded than just physical-minded as they were in the Old Testament? Shouldn't we be worried about, well, if people think this, or if I would do this to cause somebody to go astray? I know it's their choice too, but sometimes we lead people. That's why even Jesus said, lead us not into temptation, because it can happen. We can be led. And then as we share with the laver, so we got the altar of sacrifice and then the laver that was there. Again, the laver is outside of what we were going to call the church, and I'm not referring to the building, I'm talking about the ones that have been. In other words, you couldn't come in, walk in through the court of Gentiles, see the sacrifice, oh, good, priest, you made a sacrifice for me, good deal, and then decide you were going to walk in there to the table of showbread. So what the example is that the laver is there. So what does that represent? Baptism. Again, I think the denominational world tones down the size of these things because it fits their agenda. Many denominations, I've been different places, I've seen it, Lutheran, Catholic, well, they have the little bird bath up front, and it's called the baptismal font, right? And so what they'll do is they'll use that, and every time they mention baptism, the guy goes, you know, the priest or whatever, he'll make it, and so immediately in their mind, they just start to, they're being trained that the baptism is involved with this little bird bath, this little tub here. When the fact of the matter is, if you remember, when the one that was built, the laver that was built, we're given no dimensions of the one that was built in the wilderness. But the one that was built for Solomon's temple, I believe was 18 cubits across. Remember they had the big bowls that were, it was either in the translation, either 18 feet across or 18 cubits. I can't remember. Anyway, my point in my illustration that I usually use, is some of you've got one of those in your backyard and they call them swimming pools. right, is how big this would be. Not just a little baptismal font. That would make sense if that's what it was. And if we wanted to baptize somebody, you just, because you ain't putting them in there. Not the little baptismal font, but the one at Solomon's temple that was built up there, huge. And they would wash in that completely. Then you were allowed to go into the next little building of the tabernacle, which represented the church. So what does that tell us? Just using our New Testament smarts, that Jesus' sacrifice, although he has done all that he can do, would not be sufficient for us to get to heaven. Oh my goodness. Wait a minute. You mean you're telling me that Jesus didn't do everything that we need to be done for us to get to heaven? Therein lies what we need to do. That we need to be washed. That we need to be washed to get into the church. They just didn't come in, walk in, see the sacrifice, and then walk past the laver and say, I'm here, everybody, and if you know what's good for you, you better appreciate that I'm here. Because that's the way some act when they come into the services. It needs to be, again, a time of humility. I believe baptism should be, at least in our mindset somewhere, one of the most humble things that we ever do. And it's not just because you're getting your hair wet in public in front of people. It's because really what you're doing, and not just physically, but you're putting your life into someone else's hands. Now, myself as a preacher and other preachers, I've heard do the same thing, and maybe we shouldn't, where we make the reference of, right, maybe we should have just held them under till the bubbles quit and we would have helped them out in their Christian walk. Although it's tempting, right? Sometimes, really, they really are putting their life in our hands. And I don't mean that, well, if I've got sin in my life, you're not going to heaven. That's not what I'm talking about. But if I hold you underwater, and everybody out there just is like, I wonder what he's doing. You know, and there's feet flailing and arms flailing, and you're holding them there until your life is in my hands. But spiritually speaking, that's at the point in when our life is turned over to the hands of Christ, because we've shared with his death, burial, and his resurrection. And so those are the two items that are on the outside, the inside of the tabernacle when we come in, but still outside of the holy place that we're looking at. Verse number two, it seems interesting that the writer goes back to the tabernacle and not to the permanent structure known as the temple, which the Hebrews writer and readers would have been more familiar with. As we'd said, there were three different temple complexes that the Jews worshipped in: Solomon's, Zerubbabel's, and Herod's temple. Each one of them, as I said, declining in beauty and extravagance each time they lost out. Maybe it was because the first instructions were for a tabernacle structure. The temple was built to the same specifications, but no one would argue with the using of the tabernacle as the example. Hebrews 9:2. For there was a tabernacle prepared, the outer one in which were the lampstand and the table and the sacred bread. This is called the holy place. The Mosaic tabernacle consisted of two tent compartments. It references the first room where a priest would have entered into the first room, which was known as the holy place. The holy place was about 30 feet long, 15 feet wide, and 15 feet high. In the first Or the outer one was the lampstand made of pure gold and about 6 feet high, possibly weighing up to 65 pounds or one talent of gold. Three branches on each side, making it a total of seven. Three on this side, three on this side, and one through the middle. Just making sure. Giving the only light to the tabernacle since it had no windows. It is the Hebrew word menorah. The middle stick could only be lit by the altar's fire. We see that in Exodus 25, 31 through 40, and Leviticus 24, 1 through 4. The next piece of furniture was the table of showbread. It was called the showbread. So the lampstand would have been on your left. The table of showbread would have been on your right because it was called the table of showbread because it always stood before the face of God. Some translations may even call it the shewbread that we look at. I know King James, I believe, references it that way. It is called the showbread because it is always stood before the face of God. It was about 3 feet high and about a foot and a half wide. It would stay on the north side of the tent, opposite side of the lampstand. On the table were stacked 12 loaves in two piles, one loaf representing each of the tribes of Israel. The loaves changed out every Sabbath day, which is, there we go, thank you. Whew. I didn't know if we needed a whole, you know, anyway. On the top was placed a cup of frankincense. How many have ever seen the movie Seven Brides for Seven Brothers? Right? Sam, where you at? She's over there. We like that, right? Right? So remember, each one of the boys starts off and their names all start with the letter of the alphabet. They're in order. And so they go down and it's Adam. And I can't even remember. I know Caleb's the C. Benjamin. And it goes down the line. And they get to F. And the boy's name's Frank. And they're like, where did mom ever find that name out in the Bible? And they're like, oh, he's like, I was named after frankincense. So I just, every time I see frankincense, then I think of Frank from Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. Anyway, if you haven't seen it, if you happen to make it to camp, Michael Sinsatt will fill you in on all of it. Okay? Because, yeah, he even knows the guy, and I can't think of the main actor's name. Does anybody know who Adam was? Anybody? I can't remember. Is it, somebody over there got it? No? No? Yes? No? I see her talking, mumbling. Okay. Right, yeah. But anyway, what I'm saying is Michael Sinsatt knows who that is. I was just trying to prove Michael's worthiness. Okay? Anyway. Man, that was a terrible sidebar. Right, Colton? Jackson? Sidebar? Get it? Okay. You didn't laugh. So in Bible class, they have their, here, another sidebar, right? They've got their, well, they'll be talking about something, and then all of a sudden, they'll just be like, sidebar! Which means we're going to be heading in a totally different direction, and we might not get back. And I think that's what's happened to us. Anyway, all right. Frankincense. It's on here somewhere. There we go. They were not to be eaten by non-priests. Jesus referenced the instance when David and his men ate of the table of showbread. Keep in mind why the author is explaining all this, to show the distinction between the covenants and to highlight that the first sanctuary was earthly. And there's our list of Exodus and Leviticus accounts. The first tent was called the sanctuary or the holy place. When the writer says the outer one, it literally means the first one. Exodus seems to indicate that the altar of the incense was in the holy place, the first room as well. Exodus 30 verse 6 says, you shall put his altar in front of the veil that is near the ark of testimony, in front of the mercy seat that is over the ark of the testimony, where I will meet you. That's why if you look at that, some translations, the way it looks, The way it's said, we'll say, because where's the mercy seat at? It's on the top of the Ark of the Covenant, not in the holy place. Where? The Holy of Holies. And so when this says that it was placed there before that, some believe that it was in the room where the Ark of the Covenant was. I still tend to believe, and maybe that's just the old where I was, because of what does the altar of incense represent? Our prayers. They would go up and then over into heaven. I believe that's what. Also, I wanted to share, there was something else that I wanted to share. So, looking at our three items here, we've got the lampstand, which we know stands for what? Thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path. This is the word of God. The showbread is a representation of, right, the Lord's Supper. And who did we say was not allowed to eat it? Non-priests were not supposed to eat it. And then Jesus does that whole discussion with when David did that, and that's another lesson that we can get into sometime. But what does that tell us about the Lord's Supper then? We already established what Peter said about us as being priests, that those that aren't Christians, now, I tend to agree with George on this. So people say, well, so let's say a visitor comes in and they want to take the Lord's Supper and they're not a Christian. We don't know anything about them. And we're like, well, you better not do that. We don't want you to eat and drink damnation unto yourself, because we're looking at what? First Corinthians chapter 11, right? Don't do that. Wouldn't want you to do that. But we got to remember, they're lost and outside of Christ. They're already as damned or condemned as one can get. Right, that's what I always say. And so sometimes we sound like we're being spiritual by saying, you know, don't do this, but yet really what they're not saying, and what that's talking about is taking that in a worthy manner. We all know what's that. So anyway, non-Christian, non-priest, and then those prayers are represented by the altar of incense that flows up and over into the Holy of Holies, which was in heaven. And we'll go ahead and stop there tonight, because from this point forward, the next couple of verses, we're going to see where things start to change and are a bit different for us. And so I want us to be able to run and complete all of those thoughts. I just hope that you're at least as excited, because like I said, Hebrews 9 is one of, I think, the most exciting passages, just because I love to look at the comparisons there between the tabernacle of the Old Testament, seeing the provision that was made, and then what earthly provision that was made, and then the spiritual aspect of that, of what that means to us. When it comes to the layers that cover the tabernacle, there's some wonderful imagery there, showing God's protection, showing the glory of heaven, showing what God sees when he looks down upon us. It's just a wonderful, beautiful thing. But it's all in pointing out that do we want to go back to the way things used to be? As much and as cool as I think it is, I got a little model in the room over there. As cool as I like it is, as I like to look at that and see those things, I am happy. We are blessed to be on this side of the cross. And we don't have to do those things. I pointed out right from the beginning, I want to share this before the thought escapes me and we move on, that these people wanted to go back to a religion that God had given them. It almost sounds like you could justify it in your mind if you wanted to. And I think that that was maybe possibly some of their thinking. But what I'll say is what saddens me more than this book of Hebrews having to be written to Christians that wanted to go back to Judaism. And we've all are on this side and know and understand. We know, we all know people that have come to Christ, that have become his royal priests, and have decided not to go back to a former covenant, but to go back to the falsehood, to the appearing of love of the world, and to denominational factions, rather than remaining true to the body of Christ. I can almost, in a sense, justify or understand the Hebrews. Not saying they were right, but I can at least follow their line of thinking. But for someone to have come out of the denominational world and come to Christ, I beg with you, I plead with you, please do not ever even have the inclination or the thought to go back. Just keep pressing on for the cause of Christ. If you're here tonight and you're outside of Jesus Christ, that plan of salvation is to believe in who he is, that he's the only sacrifice that we need, that we are to repent of our sin, that he is that sacrifice for our sin, that we can confess Jesus Christ as Lord, that we can be immersed, that we'll be in somebody else's hands, not just the preacher's hand or a friend or a parent, but we're in the hands of God from that moment forward. That we'll be faithful, never going back, living our life as a holy priest, as a holy nation, that we are a peculiar people, that when somebody says, well, why don't you do this? Our answer is, Christ wouldn't want me to. The example that I'm setting is trying to be like him. Why don't you drink? Why don't you dress like the world? Why don't you act like the world? Because I'm not in the world. I mean, I'm not of the world. Maybe in the world, but I'm not of the world. Do your best to live that faithful life for Jesus. Jason's going to lead us in our song of invitation. And if you're here tonight and outside of Jesus, let today be your day of salvation. Please stand.
Encamped along the hills of light, ye Christian soldiers rise and pray.